Great.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sandy, when did you first think to become an artist?
Ah. Oh, no. What a question. Ah, well, I did not even know what an artist was when I was growing up in American culture. I never went to museums. I don't think I even really saw an actual painting until I went to high school. I saw some work in California, but I'd say that the concept of fine art started to make sense to me in college at Smith College. I did a lot of art history and studying the philosophy of the society that created the imagery. That connection really made a lot of sense to me in terms of a life mission, I guess, a purpose. And that, I think, I guess really is the origin of art history.
Art history.
Mm-hmm.
So you start thinking, I can become an artist, and at which school we're talking about?
College?
College.
Smith College, yeah. Uh-huh.
And which was your major at that time?
Actually art, studio art. And that would have been also the junior year that I spent in Paris. So in Paris, during that period, which would have been 66, the cinema was a big deal in aesthetic circles. And there was a lot of excitement about cinema as an art form. At the time, I didn't know what art form to pursue. I had never studied photography. I had was looking at painting as art. So I was making paintings as a young student at the college. And though my art historical studies, which were fairly extensive, in Paris, I was able to work with André Chastel, who's a very well-known Northern Renaissance specialist, and so on and so forth. Quite a number of sophisticated art historians, both in Paris and then also the college that I went to had a very important art history program. So, coming back from there and being now ready to graduate, I felt as though I wanted to be a filmmaker, because it seemed to me that film was the medium of my generation.
That's interesting. And what is your idea of beauty, or how it has been changing since you started being an artist?
Mm. Well, I think it's one of the more complicated concepts in contemporary culture, because it's related to as I said over in Hoboken, the judgment of what is beautiful is and taste in terms of how you feel that something's beautiful. What interests me is the relationship between the learned behavior of certain things and what would seem to me to be deeper, primal, almost animalistic preconceptions about what is beautiful. For example, why is it that long blonde hair on a woman is just, always exciting?
Lucky you.
Short and bleached. but there are elements like that which defy deconstruction theory, so to speak, in terms of the fact that, yes, you might be able to understand the understand it as a phenomenon or as a class-related feeling, if you will, learned feeling, but nevertheless you have the feeling. And so that interests me a lot, especially the piece I'm working on now called Fluffy, is about beauty and horror, and how in American culture, because we have almost two completely distinct classes of people, which I think are actually quite well defined in the presidential election. you know, it's like two halves, and so the for me the exploration of some almost the exploration of the other half, if you will, in terms of beauty, it interests me a lot. Now, beauty, I think, with modernism, with the 30s and 40s, most primarily coming into the 50s and 60s with the cultural revolutions in Western culture in the 60s, beauty, I think, became very suspect. Beautiful things are not beautiful things. Beautiful things are almost shallow. A new set of attributes started to become attached to, let's say, traditional sensations of beautiful surfaces and beautiful materials and things like that. And that's very deeply tied in with modernism and the strategies of contemporary art in terms of trying to find out what else is beautiful, other than, say, shiny surfaces or gold or precious things. And to kind of come up with some kind of truth, I guess it is, truthfulness or reality that in effect is another kind of beauty. And of course that's the mission of the artist, is in a sense to tell the truth as you see it, as honestly as you possibly can.
You started working as an artist in the 70s. How has your work evolved through the decades?
Well, in the 70s, I was a conceptual artist. I was committed to the idea that thinking was superior to feeling and looking and seeing and other ways of apprehending the world. This lasted for about 5 years. It started in the mid-70s when I graduated from college, came to New York, and it coincides with the minimalist era in the New York art world. So when I first moved to New York, I was enthralled with this kind of extremism. I mean, I'm always drawn to extremism, not necessarily in politics, but in gesture, in behavior, in attitude, and so on. So the extremism of minimalism and conceptualism, which came really right on the heels of minimalism, fascinated me, and I became very interested in practicing art in that way. You gonna leave?
Yeah.
And it's the development of the work, right, from the 70s. So I was starting to talk about, in the 70s, I was very interested in conceptualism because of its extreme approach to art making, that it was very, very much, in some ways, about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, which is a phrase that we have here, the disembodiment of the art object. And I did read a lot of philosophy during that time. I started to get involved with still photography as a form of expressing conceptual ideas. I had a Xerox machine. I did Xerox performance pieces in the 70s using the machine with crackers and food on it and things like that. So I guess my earliest photographic work goes back to the Xerox machine. And then shortly after the Xerox machine, I started becoming interested in the phenomenon of similarity and difference in our visual field. I think, especially in the United States, with the importance of democracy as an idea, the importance of everyone being able to have anything and everything, if they want, or if they want to work hard enough, or what have you. These kind of things are very powerful in our culture, and so the reflection of that in terms of structures that are very similar, like McDonald's being the same all over, or housing developments where the houses are very similar, is reflecting really that, in my mind, that democratic ideal, if you will, that of, you know, every people can have everything for everybody, so to speak. So that sort of translation into the visual field interested me in terms of the American landscape. So I started to photograph motels, and by photographing the motels, they were very much about the similarity, difference. They looked like the same little house, but they were actually different. And then the background became very important to understanding what you were looking at, because you thought, you would think it was the same little house, but it actually was different because a tree was different. So this kind of sameness and yet diversity within the sameness, the homogeneity, interested me in the 70s. And then I think that filtered in through with the early 80s. I went through a period where I floundered and didn't know what to do, because I felt as though what I was doing was so inaccessible. It was very rarefied, academic, and out of reach of the mainstream culture, for sure, and even, you know, most of the culture. So, I mean, really the only people that were impressed with the work were other practitioners. So that led me back to filmmaking again, as an idea, because filmmaking, even in an extreme form of art, filmmaking nevertheless has ingredients which immediately are understandable to the person at large. Yeah,
the viewer.
So I felt as though maybe again filmmaking was something I needed to look at. So I made some films. I did a documentary film, and this was all at the same time that I was developing a teaching career and my early years in New York. And it was through the process of making films and the intense collaboration with other people that was required that I was able to eliminate filmmaking. I mean, I love watching films. I'm actually enjoying it less now, but for about 20 years, I loved watching films, but every time I would make a film, I felt it was too big a compromise to have to work with all these other creative entities, you know, the cameraman or, all that kind of stuff. So so that led me back to the studio experience and indirectly to still photography through the conceptual devices of documenting conceptual ideas. So my early photography interests were really not coming out of the history of photography as an art form. They were really coming out of contemporary art and conceptual strategy. So the artists I was influenced by were John Baldessari, William Wegman, people who were taking pictures, but they weren't really following a pictorial tradition.
This is the 80s. Then how it evolved in the 90s?
So in the 80s, I started, the real breakthrough came with my interest in advertising and questioning the presupposition that fine art and commercial art are enemies or are completely different. And I felt as though that was an extreme kind of judgment, and that somehow for me, commercial strategies had something to offer that had not been really discussed. One of those things was the idea of communication between the maker of the artwork and the receiver or the viewer. And I felt as though with commercial art, there was a real sense of completion of that dialogue, that you made the work knowing that someone was going to look at it, and you wanted them to, very consciously in your mind, you wanted them to have some way of understanding and apprehending that. Whereas the late 70s with conceptualism, there was really a disdain for the viewer and no interest in making compromises that would make the work, let's say, more entertaining or more engaging. So the idea of entertainment or engagement were stigmatic, really, in the 70s and in terms of minimalism. I mean, certainly not entertaining work. So all of those issues of entertainment, engagement, even the idea of making a picture that was a sort of a visual explosion became very clear and crystallized to me right around 1979, 1980. And I started to make photographs partly because I felt like I wanted to bring things into an interior. It was very funny for me. And it was a performance that I did by myself, but I was laughing to myself doing these performances. And they were parodies of commercial art strategies. So, for example, the earliest work was really food still life. So I would go to the supermarket and buy frozen peas and frozen corn and things that were already pretty artificialized, and then I would arrange them in maniacally patterned artificial ways. So that was sort of a working off of pattern painting on the one hand, and on the other hand, it was pattern painting, but it was painting patterns with the wrong things, you know, with these sort of inappropriate peas, carrots, and things like that. So the still photography started to become a challenge for me to actually make commercial-looking pictures. That started to interest me. How do I make a picture that's very well lit, that's very sharp focused, that's, you know, kind of got all of the controls, really, that you see in commercial advertising photography? So right around 1980, I said, I want to make and take all the commercial photography strategies that I see around me and implement them, but not for a commercial purpose. And so out of that came Radioactive Cats in 1980, and with that piece, there was another sort of departure, because that was sort of a decision between, up to that point I've been using found objects, and they were all kitsch, and they were stupid things, you know, cheap things made for consumer culture. And found objects, of course, goes back to modernism with Duchamp. They always talk about the culture. They don't really necessarily talk about the artist, the individual artist. I mean, they almost always have a kind of a conceptual, cultural critique embedded in the use of the object itself. So here I was wanting to make a picture with cats, and I really could have gone and found cats. Ceramic cats that were made for lawn furniture or decoration and done the piece that way. But I felt as though I wanted the work to have a more of a depth of feeling on my part, and to sort of, again, reintroduce something that had, in a sense, been thrown out by again, by modernism, which was the handmade object. And so a pattern in my work is to sort of move away from the handmade object to some extent, to get very extreme with kitsch and found objects, and then to kind of re-engage with handmade things or the touch or the feel. And in the case of Radioactive Cats, I made the cats. So I decided that I was going to, instead of using found cats, I was going to sculpt them. And from there on, then, started a kind of pattern of these relatively elaborate, sometimes fast or short, but a kind of performance. Sometimes the performance element was very extensive and lengthy, like you saw the eggshells, which that piece began with 50,000 eggshells. I mean, began with the vision of people actually walking on eggshells. It's a phrase, walking on eggshells, that is pan-cultural. It transcends American culture. And it's very expressive of the human condition. And I liked that phrase. So then I said, I'm going to just illustrate that phrase.
And now, let's say, after the 90s, into the new millennium,
right,
we're still at the same level, or it's still evolving?
Well, I think, I don't know that we ever know whether we're still evolving, because it's really not about the conscious awareness of what you're doing always comes later to the intuition and the feeling. So, and there's usually about a 5-year distance, I think, before you're aware of, oh, this is what I was thinking of at the time. Right now, I'm interested in using the computer because it exists. And to some extent, my work has been very naturally involved with the computer look, even though I wasn't using the computer in the early days. So now I'm working with the computer and seeing where it can take me in terms of ideas about the artificial landscape.
How do you choose final type and size of the prints and the edition of your work?
Well, up till now, I've been pretty consistent with the size in an edition. So, for example, Radioactive Cats was an edition of 20. With 10 artist proofs, so the whole edition is 30 with, say, one BAT, a printer's proof. The edition numbers vary between that and about 40. They've been consistent for about 10 to 20 years, and that's because the work takes a very long to do. And so I might actually make one image in a year, or even two. Walking on eggshells took 2 years to do. So a larger edition makes sense, because I'm also interested in the longevity of the work. So if there are more prints out there, it means chances are that eventually there will be some for posterity that that will survive.
Yeah, there are only a few images, and then...
Right. If there are only three, then those three collectors have to take good care of those images.
Do you think, off of your mind, photography as realism or fictionism?
I think of it as, well, fictionism. But I think of fictionism as truth. Fiction is truth. If we read fiction, even the most fantastic fiction, the best fiction, the good fiction, is always telling us something that's true. It's just telling it through that method of artifice, if you will. So it's a very strange relationship.
What do you think of digital photography now?
Well, I don't think anything of digital photography. Digital photography can be anything. It can be photography that's done with a digital camera. It can be photography that's done with film and then scanned and then put in the computer. It can be, digital photography can be a print that's digital, but the actual photograph is analog or intact. So for me, we're in a big transition, I think. I think that it's very exciting to be a photographer, personally, and going through this digital transformation. I don't feel a loss, although I know in terms of things like evidence, that photography is evidence, that there's a certain faith that photography used to tell the truth, or that it was somehow wedded to a real moment in time. I don't feel that loss, really. I feel more an expansion of possibilities into the universe of the imagination. I'm not terribly interested in digital photography that just does cheap surrealism. I mean, that unfortunately is very much happening and is certainly saturating the magazines. But I think for the artistic purposes of really saying something about your period of time, your life, your culture, I think that there's nothing keeping digital photography from doing that.
What is a typical reaction of the audience in front of one of your work? Have you ever noticed that?
I do notice that. I'm really interested in that. What that is surprise, I think. What I look for, for me, the moment of success is that someone stands there and looks at it for a lengthy period of time. Now, the nice thing about still photography compared to film is that you're not a prisoner. So if you are there for 30 seconds, that's a long time in today's
world.
Whereas the trouble with film really is you're a prisoner. I mean, in order to give the work its due, you must be a prisoner of the time and space of the film, the unraveling of it. And I've become less and less willing to do that myself.
Mm-hmm. Is there a work in your imagination which has been impossible to achieve so far?
That's a good, I'm trying to think. My first reaction to that is to say no, but I'm sure there are. Of course there are things. But I think that what happens to me is that if I get ideas and let's say usually it would be a practical reason that I wouldn't be able to do it. Maybe I don't have enough space or I don't have enough money or time. So the answer is yes, absolutely. I'm sure there are many things which right now I can't think of particularly, but those would be the reasons, I think.
And so meaning that from the idea to the final piece, mm-hmm. there is a long process in your work.
There is, yes.
Do you use sketches or is just everything is in your mind?
It's more fun in your mind to leave it open. When I was younger, I used to do more sketching. I actually hope to do more sketching now because I'm just calmer. But having moved from New York, but I actually have spent about the last 10 years hardly doing any sketches. The only I do, of course, have notebooks, but the notebooks are
a list of things.
A list of things, exactly. Like one list after another, you know, call so-and-so, you know, and the art will be woven in with go shopping for some cheese and bread, and then, you know, or go buy mannequins or research mannequins, or so it's, you know.
So there's no preparation drawing, it's all, you collect all the material,
mm-hmm.
and the actual piece is coming up in front of you,
mm-hmm.
working on it.
Speak to me, right, like the eyes, right? It took me a month. Go on the internet. I mean, in the early days without an internet, you would have to call, you would look in the yellow pages, you would do research in the same way that they do in the cinema, prop people do. There are reference books for that kind of thing. So now the internet is, again, it's a little more democratic. You just type in what you want and you get, you know, you just have to keep searching. But the eyes are a good example of that, where just getting, you know, there's no substitute for actually having those eyes, you know, having the glass eyes, the plastic eyes, the blue, the green, and then, you know, trying them and seeing if they're going to work. So there's a period where I give that concept the opportunity to fail. I mean, it may not work. I may have to say, not now, package the eyes up. There for another piece. Right now it's in the stage of, I think they'll work, I'm very excited about them.
It ever happened that you had at the same time two ideas to
mm-hmm.
make?
Mm-hmm. Many times. And it's very hard for me to work simultaneously on two pieces. Partly because I am really insane. I mean, I only seem to be normal, so the ability to really focus on something is part of